Hi there, welcome to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer, always great to have your company. This week, a terror attack in London again, and one in Melbourne.
We are treating it as a terrorism incident. The reason for that is that the individual that we ended up having to shoot last night, he's known to us from some years ago as having been involved in a terrorism matter up in New South Wales back in about 2009. He has a long criminal history with us, but also we understand from yesterday, from what we're piecing together, comments he made related to ISIS and Al-Qaeda certainly put this for us in the terrorism category, and our counter-terrorism task force, that's the standing task force we have, us and the Commonwealth, we're working on the matter as a terrorism matter today.
We'll try to get inside the mind of a suicide bomber, an inmate at the British prison where Theodore Dalrymple, otherwise known as Anthony Daniels, where he worked as a doctor in the 1990s and 2000s. Who knows, that might help us better understand the problem of Islamic extremism. Plus, does it really matter that the United States pulled out of the Paris Climate Accords? If you go back to late 2015, when Paris was signed, do you remember what all those prominent climate activists were saying? Jim Hansen, George Monbiot, Bill McKibben, they were complaining that, unlike Kyoto, Paris is weak and futile. Besides, my guest today thinks that US emissions are coming down faster than much of Europe, and that's thanks to technological innovation. Stay with us for my chat with an environmental economist from Canada. What drives a person, all too often a young Muslim male, to kill innocents in their midst? And what does this mean for our efforts to combat these kinds of terror threats? What do you think? You may have heard of Theodore Dalrymple. That's the pen name for Anthony Daniels, a British physician and a former prison doctor. He was in Australia last year as a guest of the Centre for Independent Studies. It's a liberal think tank, which, as it happens, I'll head in 2017. He's a regular contributor to The Spectator in London, the Manhattan Institute's City Journal, and the Wall Street Journal, where he wrote the lead article on this very subject. Theodore, welcome back to the ABC.
Thank you.
How do you get inside the mind of someone who thinks it's a good thing to murder and terrorise innocent people, including children, as we witnessed in Manchester last month?
Well, I'm not sure that one really does want to get into their mind, because if one could understand it, that would be slightly sinister. Mm. And I'm not sure that if one could, it would really help very much. I think what one just needs to see is how they're behaving. And to be perfectly honest, I don't really understand it, and I don't think I will ever understand it.
Well, tell us about your experience with the suicide bomber who was an inmate at the British prison where you worked.
Well, he was a would-be suicide bomber. He was a very nasty individual. He had a long life of crime, and from the very earliest age, he'd done everything bad that he possibly could, and he decided to redeem himself, as he thought, by blowing himself up and taking as many people with him as possible for the sake of Allah.
And did you find that coming to religion was a pretext for abandoning crime, with not just this fellow, but just generally speaking, most of these jihadists?
It is a pretext, often a pretext for abandoning crime. People abandon crime often in their 30s anyway, but many of them want a reason for doing so, and so they take to religion. Unfortunately, often now the religion they take to is Islam rather than Christianity.
Yeah, I mean, on that note though, why Islam and not Christianity?
Well, I think many of the people that I saw who converted killed two birds with one stone by doing that. They became religious and therefore had a reason for giving up common types of crime. But at the same time, they didn't feel that by giving up crime, they were in a way surrendering to society. On the contrary, they knew that in general society would be afraid of them because they had converted. So this satisfied their need to be in opposition to society while at the same time giving up crime.
In your Wall Street Journal article this week, you talk about the ideology of these jihadists, how it's evil and stupid. If it's so evil and stupid, how do you account for its appeal to so many young Muslims?
Well, of course, evil and stupidity have always appealed to quite large numbers of people. And the mere fact that something is self-evidently stupid doesn't necessarily mean that it can't spread or doesn't spread. The thing is, of course, that most of the bombers have been brought up in Muslim households, and the hold of Islam on people seems to be extremely strong even when they move away from it.
Okay. But you also make the point that an ideology, however stupid, is not easy to destroy. So what's the best way of dealing with this then?
Well, I think it has to be constantly attacked because if you don't attack it, you half accept it. And unfortunately, many of our leaders are halfway to accepting it.
Yeah.
When you listen to Mrs. May, for example, she said that innocent people had been killed by the suicide bombers. This is to accept that there are guilty people whom it would be less heinous to kill. The word innocent is quite wrong in this context. And we should stop, of course, calling them cowards. They're not cowards. One thing that they're not is cowardly. They're, in a sense, extremely brave. But bravery is not a virtue unless it's in pursuit of something worthwhile or virtuous.
On that note, though, do you think there's something in the nature of British society that has led to this perverse outcome that allows British jihadists to take root? I mean, some of our conservative friends in England will blame multiculturalism, but then I think of France, that's also obviously been subjected to a lot of Islamic terror, yet it doesn't really subscribe to multiculturalism. So how do you account for all this?
Well, yes, I don't think that multiculturalism does explain it. It might explain our reluctance to criticize the culture from which these people come, but it doesn't explain it in itself. And after all, most of the Islamic violence occurs in Islamic countries, which are definitely not multicultural in the sense that Britain is supposedly is. So I don't think multiculturalism does explain it. And incidentally, it's the same also as far as the psychological or sociological profile of the terrorists. There may be a certain type of terrorist that one recognizes, but nevertheless, there are people of all types who become terrorists.
Yes, you downplay the role of multiculturalism, but nevertheless, in your Wall Street Journal article, you refer to what a Dutch friend of yours calls creative appeasement. And I'll just read this bit in your article. Authorities make concessions even before one suspects there have been any demands for them. Thus, a public library in Birmingham, one of the largest known to me, has installed women-only tables, a euphemism for Muslim women only.
Yes. Yes, and there are other kind of concessions that are made, and it's very difficult to discover why they have been made and whether there was any demand for them to have been made. In other words, people, authorities have anticipated demands rather than accepted demands. But in any case, what this does is give Islamists and would-be terrorists the idea that they have society on the run and that the society is a bit like a rotten fruit waiting to fall from the tree. I think they're mistaken in that, of course, but I can understand why they should think that in the light of the experience that nobody ever draws a line and just says no.
My guest is Theodore Dalrymple. He's the pen name for the legendary writer Anthony Daniels, former prison doctor and psychiatrist, who's just co-written a book, What Is Wrong With Us? Essays in Cultural Pathology. Are these folks just searching for some kind of relevance? That is, in our world, like most people, they're just ordinary. They do this. They are great. It's very simplistic, but I wonder if they're searching for some kind of glory.
Yes, I think, of course, there's a considerable amount of grandiosity in what they do. I mean, they're usually people of relatively limited accomplishment who want to be and do become, actually, extremely important, unfortunately important in a very bad way. But there are certainly, amongst criminals in general, there is that.
But then some of these jihadists, though, hail from reasonably prosperous families too, correct?
Yes, yeah, yes, they do, yes.
And medical students have blown themselves up, crikey.
Yes, poverty is definitely not the the explanation for this, nor is lack of opportunity. I mean, medical students can't claim that the society hasn't offered them any opportunity. So these explanations don't work.
What's the rough percentage of Muslims in Britain who support or sympathise with jihadists?
Well, surveys, whatever value you place on such surveys, show that quite a high percentage do. They vary, but it may be a third, when asked, express some kind of sympathy for the terrorists and terrorism. What that actually means, of course, is difficult to interpret.
Yeah, now finally, I have to ask you about the big issue in the Middle East this week, and that, of course, is Qatar, the divorce between Qatar and Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Gulf states. Now, to what extent are the governments of not just Qatar, but also Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, among others, to what extent are they aiding and abetting these Sunni jihadists across not just the Middle East, but also the West?
Well, I think I'm no expert on this subject, but it does seem that indirectly they have funded an enormous amount of not necessarily jihadi, but Wahhabi type Islam. And of course, these two are not 100 miles apart.
No. Well, I mean, to the extent that that is true, why not just stop aid to these nations?
Because they have so much money.
Theodore Dalrymple, otherwise known as Anthony Daniels, always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks so much for being on Between the Lines today.
Thank you very much.
That was Theodore Dalrymple, the pen name of Anthony Daniels, a former prison doctor and psychiatrist whose article on this subject can be found on the Wall Street Journal editorial page website.
On RN, this is Between the Lines with Tom Switzer.
Well, it's been a week since President Trump's decision to pull the US out of the Paris Climate Accord. And the response, well, frankly, it's been overwhelmingly hostile.
We are going to lose millions of jobs for hardworking Americans because the president is going to honor a promise to the coal industry.
The president who talked about putting America first has now put America last. Together with Syria, which is in the midst of a civil war, and Nicaragua, which thought the agreement didn't go far enough. He's made us an environmental pariah in the world, and I think it is one of the most self-destructive moves I've ever seen by any president in my lifetime.
As two prominent Liberal Democrats, Ed Markey and John Kerry, he's a former Secretary of State, they're both from Massachusetts. Now remember, their criticisms reflect the prevailing wisdom in the media and policy circles. But there's always a counter-argument in topical debates, isn't there? And so today, let's hear from one of the critics of the Paris climate orthodoxy. Ross McKittrick is a professor of economics and chair in sustainable commerce at the University of Guelph, where he specialises in environmental economics. He's also an adjunct fellow at the Cato Institute in Washington and senior fellow of the Fraser Institute in Vancouver. Ross, welcome to ABC Radio.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Now, you just heard the overwhelmingly hostile response to the president's decision to pull the US out of Paris. Why are they wrong?
Well, I think, first of all, you have to take it with a bit of grain of salt because they are partisan. But in the case of the Paris Accord, it's very important to remember that this is based on computer model projections that say global warming is going to be a big problem. Those same models say that Paris will do nothing to change that. if you graph the climate changes over the 20th century or 21st century under business as usual and compare it to the graph with Paris fully enforced, the two lines overlap almost exactly. At a cost of hundreds of trillions of dollars, it doesn't change the underlying trajectory of global warming. So it's a very flawed policy approach for that reason.
So in other words, the Paris Treaty, in your mind, will have no impact on net carbon emissions. And add to that, I think the critics like yourself would argue that Paris, unlike Kyoto, is not binding, it's not enforceable, and it's not verifiable. Well, in that case, why then pull out?
Well, you could also ask, why bother be in it?
But I mean, wouldn't it be better for the United States to remain part of the process so it can renegotiate the terms inside the club?
Well, the United States is different from a lot of other countries. So in Canada, for instance, we signed Kyoto, and the government at the time, the Liberal government under Chrétien, never had any intention of complying with it. But you can do that in Canada. The courts will not force the government to comply with the treaty. It's established principle. Governments can break their promises, and the response is at the voting booth, not in court. In the U.S., it's different, though. If the government signed an agreement, the courts will enforce it. They will force the government to enact policies that subsequent government may not want to enact. So there is a legal risk in the U.S. that the administration had to reckon with. The NDC, it's called the Nationally Determined Contribution, that the Obama administration submitted to Paris, included specific policies such as the Clean Power Plan, and the Trump administration's rescinded the Clean Power Plan. So at this point, they're already out of compliance with their Paris commitment, and the risk is that a court could force them to reinstate the Clean Power Plan because their signature is still on the Paris Accord. This was a legal argument within the administration. There were people on both sides, and eventually the position of the White House counsel prevailed, that they faced a legal risk that they couldn't afford to live with.
It's a very important point you make, because in all of the coverage, certainly here in Australia, about Trump's decision, hardly anyone has made that point, that the courts were always likely to use the Paris Treaty as an excuse to keep in place those Obama-era regulations. So I'm glad you made that point. But nevertheless, your critics, Ross, the conventional wisdom, they will respond and say that Trump and people like you don't understand the way that the climate and the economy interact, that when you do less to fight climate change, as Trump apparently is doing, he's missing a chance for America to move ahead with clean energy technology. That is, what he's done here is going to cost jobs rather than increase them. How would you respond to that counter-argument?
You don't need to pass laws and sign treaties and so forth to force people to do something that's profitable and beneficial to them. They're going to do that anyway. So if these really are great business opportunities for American industry, don't worry. American industry is very good at finding profitable ventures to get into. The only reason that this was a policy in the first place was to force countries to enact emission reduction policies that are actually very costly. So I just completely disagree with claims like John Kerry and Ed Markey were making that somehow getting out of the Paris Treaty is going to harm the economy and cost jobs. All the respected analysis shows the opposite. And again, just common sense. If cutting CO2 emissions was very profitable and was an avenue for job growth, then you don't need Paris. I mean, if they're really right, we don't need the Paris Treaty. It's going to happen anyway.
Well, the intriguing thing is, and listeners may not be aware of this, but US carbon emissions are coming down. They're down to pre-94 level. And yet the United States does not have a carbon tax or an emissions trading cap and trade scheme. Why then, Ross, are emissions coming down?
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because the U.S. also famously pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol. And
mind you, the Senate rejected it 95 to zip after Bill Clinton had signed it in 1997, but go on.
Yeah, what happened in the United States is the cost of natural gas came down dramatically. In the 1990s, natural gas was getting very expensive because the major producing fields were running out more quickly than was expected. But then the fracking revolution came along, and horizontal drilling and other technologies that suddenly opened up vast new supplies of natural gas, to the extent that a lot of power plants, when it came time to upgrade their equipment, realized it was cheaper to replace their coal-fired boilers with natural gas boilers. So there's been a big switch in the U.S. away from coal towards natural gas. But that was not driven by climate regulations, which, as you say, haven't been in place in the United States. That was driven by relative prices of fossil fuels and technological change.
Interesting point you make, one that I made at the Sydney Opera House about 18 months ago, 2 years ago, with the Canadian climate activist Naomi Klein. I'm sure you know of Naomi. Now, she said that the shale fracking revolution that you just mentioned is not just bad for the environment, but in any case is not responsible for the lower emissions in the United States. And she attributes America's declining emissions to a sluggish economic recovery after the Great Recession.
Oh, I thought that reducing emissions is a great pathway for economic growth. So why would she say that reducing...
Well, she was acknowledging that emissions were coming down. I mean, that's a fact, but in the United States, at least, they're skyrocketing in China and India. But her point was it wasn't because of the shale fracking revolution.
Yeah, if she was right, if it was just sluggish growth in the U.S., then that would mean that emissions were still going up. They'd be sluggish, and they'd be growing at a slower rate. But no, there's been an absolute decline in emissions, even with economic growth in the United States. And the absolute decline is clearly because of the switch from coal towards natural gas, especially in the Northeast sector where the power plants, the aging power plants are being replaced. The coal ones are being replaced with natural gas.
Now, meanwhile, the non-OECD, developing countries, that accounts for 58% of global carbon emissions. Now, will that figure decrease substantially as China and India start to decarbonize their economies and lead the world in greening the planet?
Well, I think we need to step back and ask how realistic it is. I hear that in Canada all the time. People point to China and saying, oh, they're all switching to wind energy. No, China and India are investing heavily in coal-fired power plants. China has a lot of domestic coal. And they need to industrialize. They are low-income countries with a lot of poverty and a need for industry, and their governments have made it quite clear, as they should. They are pursuing economic development. I think they could be a lot cleaner about their power plants. They'd benefit from scrubbers and better technology, but they're going to use their domestic coal resources for a reliable supply of electricity, which is what they need. They are not decarbonizing, and when China's commitments on this is not to decarbonize, it's to continue to have its emissions grow out to 2030. And then at that point, they will look at the possibility of emission reductions. At that point, it'll be moot for China, though, because their population will have peaked and it'll be going down. And for most countries in the world, it's actually population that drives emissions more than anything else.
If you've just tuned in, you're on RN. I'm Tom Switzer, and my guest today is Ross McKittrick. He's an environmental economist who's with the Fraser Institute in Vancouver and the Cato Institute in Washington. Ross, the prevailing wisdom in the media, at least certainly in this country, is that the US-China deal that was signed in November 2015, just on the eve of the G20 meeting in Brisbane, this was a climate change game changer. Is that still the case?
Well, it was a clever move by Obama, I must admit, because a big argument in Washington was stalling their activity in negotiations was the claim that why should we do this when China isn't going to do anything? And we're competitors in foreign trade with China, so we shouldn't do anything. And Obama kind of nipped that argument in the bud by saying, I've just signed a deal directly with China that they are going to do something. It's when you look at the fine print that all they said that they would do is revisit the issue in 2030. And they were open to the possibility of...
So it wasn't legally binding, enforceable, or verifiable.
Yes. And as far as verifiable goes, the data out of China is notoriously bad. People have to check it and double-check it, and then years later they find out, oh, there's a whole bunch more coal consumption than they told us at the time. Their emissions have gone up much more than they said. So I would say that was a clever political move to sign a bilateral agreement with China, but as far as an actual substantive agreement, no, there is nothing to it.
What about that UN Global Climate Fund? I mean, with the US now out of Paris, where do things stand with that UN initiative? Now, this is where the rich nations foot the bill. I think it's something like $100 billion a year from 2020 onwards. How on earth is the developed world going to fund that kind of money for climate mitigation in the developing world when the Americans are out of it?
Well, there was similar initiatives around the time of Kyoto. And all that really happens, even when it looks like money is going into those funds, all that's happening is countries are diverting development assistance. So if Australia was going to give $5 billion to, I don't know, build hospitals in Africa or something, they'll just say the $5 billion is now going to go to tree planting or some kind of climate initiative like that. So it doesn't represent new money. And in fact, I think it does harm to the developing countries because it diverts money away from high priority uses to stuff that they can tick the box on the climate treaty. With the U.S. out, that certainly destroys any incentives for the other countries, though, to respect their commitments, because the developing countries really hoped that with Obama in power, they could count on a big fat check coming from the climate fund. But with Trump, they're not getting anything. So I don't think the other countries are going to fill that gap.
One of the intriguing things about this debate, Ross, is that with Trump's decision to pull out of Paris, Europe is outraged. Much of the world's outraged, but Europe in particular is outraged. Yet, is it true that U.S. emissions are actually coming down faster than much of Europe?
I believe so. I'd have to look at the specific numbers, but it is a rather exquisite point of hypocrisy here that the U.S. has reduced its emissions as much as it has. And in Europe, a big part of their emission reductions had to do with the reunification of Germany and shutting down of a lot of old East German industries. Mm-hmm. And that gave them a one-time reduction in emissions. But Germany, for instance, is now investing heavily in coal-fired power plants.
Is that a fact?
After the Fukushima disaster in Japan, they made an overreaction, I think. They decided to shut down all their nuclear reactors. And they've invested heavily in wind energy and solar, but it doesn't really provide the power necessary for German industry. So what's left? They have natural gas plants, but they're dependent on Russia for their gas supply, so they don't like that. So they're turning to coal. They are investing in new coal-fired power plants.
What happens now with global efforts to mitigate against climate change now that the Americans are out of Paris, Ross?
Well, it's always been an odd thing that the most effective strategies that we have is to learn adaptation. I mean, the whole point of it being climate, not weather, is that these are long, slow processes that you have a lot of lead time to think about and adapt to. And also, there has never been a policy on the table. There's never been an option where we actually stop the climate from changing. No one has ever proposed a policy that is anything remotely close to that. Certainly Paris wasn't. So the thinking really should be around adaptation, vulnerability, which regions of the world can we say are more vulnerable than others. And that should be our first line of thinking. As far as mitigation goes, pretty much anything that comes out of international diplomacy and policy initiatives is going to be dwarfed by technological change and energy efficiency improvements of the kind that we've seen for decades, and the kind that has led the U.S. emissions to fall as much as it has even without climate policy.
Ross, it's always important to hear counter-arguments against the prevailing wisdom. A pleasure to have you on RN today.
Thanks for the call.
That was Professor Ross McKittrick, an environmental economist at the University of Guelph in Canada. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Between the Lines. Always great to have your company. Now, remember, if you'd like to download this episode or back issues, or just send us a comment, go to abc.net.au/RN and follow the prompt to Between the Lines. I'm Tom Switzer. Hope you can tune in again next week.